So I'm here with Paul Schrader, who is most recently the director, I almost said writer, it doesn't bear your stamp, of Adam Resurrected. Paul, how are you doing today?
I am fine, thank you.
First off, I wanted to ask you, I suppose we should start from the beginning. You did not initiate this project, you were actually asked to direct it. I'm curious what attracted you. Was it merely the script or were there other factors? What is the decision-making process for when you decide just to direct something?
Well, the script was offered to me. I would not have thought I would be the person to do this. I mean, I'm not Jewish, and I think there's been plenty of Holocaust movies, and the world certainly didn't need another one, and not one from me. So I didn't think I would do this. But when I read it, this metaphor of the man who used to be the dog, who meets a dog who used to be a boy, was so inspired and so original that it transcended all my other qualms. And in fact, the metaphor can stand alone for any kind of recovery. It doesn't have to be the Holocaust per se, which is the framing trauma of this story.
Sure. Now, Jeff Goldblum in this has an affected German-Jewish accent that runs counter to his unmistakable cadences and his speech patterns. I'm curious, I know that he actually studied for this role for about a year. I read reports that he was crawling around and crying for months. But I'm wondering how much of having Jeff work against his natural tics was your idea and how much was his?
I told Jeff fairly early on that we had to break free of some of the assumptions that people bring to his performances. And I felt that the accent would be an immediate sign that this is not kind of a typical performance from Jeff. When I read the script, I hadn't even finished the script. I was maybe 60 pages into it. The idea of Jeff just hit me. And I didn't know Jeff. And I was reading the script, and I said to my wife as she walked through the room, I said, I'm reading the script, and there's an actor who was born to play this role. It's Jeff Goldblum. He spent his whole life preparing to play this role. And sure enough, when it finally was put together, Jeff was the actor.
Yeah, but surely if he is trying to escape his natural mannerisms, certainly he has to bring something of his natural mannerisms to this particular role. He does, I think. And
I'm wondering. Of course, you cannot escape yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, actors like everyone have a limited repertoire of skills and abilities and personal quirks.
Yeah. But I mean, the preparation process, was this his idea or your idea? I mean, how did this work out?
You always encourage actors to prepare. And I've been fortunate to work with a number of actors who were quite diligent that way, but nobody as extreme as Jeff. Yeah. He was certainly the most obsessively prepared actor I've ever worked with, almost to the point where you'd have to tell him to back off a little bit.
How so exactly? Were there specific scenarios where he was really going way over the top? Or
No. I just meant that it was just consuming his life so much that that the element of play was being lost in all of the preparation. Yeah. And you can't do so much preparation that you strip away spontaneity.
Sure. So in terms of like having to essentially reprogram his natural delivery, so to speak, I mean, there had to have been some balance worked out or some agreement worked out between you and him to get this mix between this uber preparation and the spontaneity that you're speaking of.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually quite blunt with him fairly early on. I said that, you know, I told him that the rap against him in the past by some people has been that people feel that he's winking at them when he's performing, that he sort of is above the character, above the situation, and he's using one eye to look at you and the other eye to wink to the side. Yeah. And I said, that is what we cannot have in this. You know, you have to be inside the character. You cannot be outside the character at all. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was really kind of blunt with him up front that was necessary, and he understood that.
Did you supervise any of the preparation process, or was this a largely kind of solitary exercise for you?
Well, normally you sort of have to kind of bird dog an actor to make sure that they do the research that you want them to do. You know, put them in touch with people, you know, keep bugging them. But in Jeff's case, it was sort of the opposite. I only found out later how much he had actually been doing.
Oh, got it. I wanted to also ask about the source material, Joachim Kaniuk's novel, which is itself quite an imposing allegory. I mean, you can compare it to Absalom. Absalom as being almost an untranslatable novel. In other interviews, you have said that that it is an untranslatable novel and that this film presents a more simplistic version of it. So if that's the case, why transfer this into a film? Why adapt it if it's not going to necessarily be? Or is it just a kind of counterpart to the book? Or?
Well, the producer, Ehud Blyberg, had read this book when he was on leave from the Lebanese war. And he became obsessed with it. And he spent 20 years adapting it. And so that was the whole force behind it. So by the time it came to me, the script was completed, and they essentially had the money to do it. The book has a long history. When Joram first wrote it, they were thinking of Louis Milestone to do it. Yeah. That's a long history. Charlie Chaplin was interested. Orson Welles was interested. So this has had a history. And the book is of a certain kind of literary period. So it's written in 68, published in the U.S. in 71. That puts it at the same sort of time as Slaughterhouse-Five, Ten Drum, Catch-22, all books written 20 years after the war by men who were in the war and looking back at it with a kind of jaundiced and cynical eye. And Adam fits very much into that literary tradition, which made the book very controversial in Israel. Because it does not treat the Holocaust with the kind of reverence that a lot of people think it should be treated, and has made the film somewhat problematic in some of the screenings we've had, because the film runs contrary to two of the givens about films about Holocaust. You know, films about the Holocaust, by and large, are based on fact. This actually happened. And the reverential, you know, all those poor people, they suffered so much. Well, this is not based on fact. There never was a hospital like this. There never was a commandant-prisoner relationship like this. And certainly it's not reverential.
Yeah.
And so it throws people who have a kind of fixed notion of what films on this subject matter should be.
But back to the issue of here is this really intricate, magical realist novel, and here is this film. I mean, is what purpose does it serve aside from the fact that it's its own independent entity? Is that essentially what you're going for here?
Well, I mean, the novel operates at a different level. The film is much more accessible. It's obviously much shorter. And there is something to be gained by seeing this Adam performed, you know. Do books need to be adapted into movies? I don't know. That's a good question. Maybe no books should ever be adapted into movies.
But books have served very well for you over the course of your career in terms of adaptations.
I've done a few. I did Affliction, and I did Last Temptation, Comfort of Strangers. Yeah.
I mean, do you find that working from a template is better for you as a writer in terms of having some pre-existing structure with which to respond to, whether it's a remake of Cat People or even a novel of some kind? Or do you, I mean, what works best for you?
Not really. In a case like Affliction, I think I really nailed that book, and I was very faithful to that book. You mentioned Cat People. I wish I had changed the title. I think that film was hurt by using the title Cat People, because it has the film I made had nothing to do with the original.
Yeah.
But so I should have just changed the title.
Well, in this case, I mean, what kind of writing did you do? Did you do any sort of rewriting of the actual
screenplay?
Well,
I mean, this was written. It was a very good script. It was written by a first-time writer, and so therefore it was a bit overwritten. You know, the sort of, if something is worth saying, it's worth saying twice kind of writing. So I knew I had to take some time out of it. And so in the process of taking about 20 pages out of it, you know, you start to take ownership over it as well.
I wanted to actually also ask you about working with cinematographer Sebastian Edschmid. You chose black and white for the scenes in Germany, and you gradually see color return as we get to the present, in at least the present in the movie, which was, you know, years ago. And I'm wondering why you opted to do black and white. Was this a way of disguising the age of the actors so that we wouldn't really see them age? Or
no, it's just you're mimicking the dominant film look of that time. So if you're in the 20s, it's kind of contrasty black and white. You get into the 30s, and it's more of a plus X black and white. You get into the 50s, and it's a kind of ektachrome sort of color. So you're just mimicking what people's memory of films from that time look like.
Got it. Now, in terms of the low-key lighting situations, particularly in the early, in the flashback scenes, I'm curious if this was more about reflecting the time, or were some of the budgetary restrictions that you had with this...
The primary decision was reflecting the times, the same decision I made in Mishima, where I did the very same thing. However, you know, we were able to save a little money, particularly on the concentration camp, because the buildings we used, in fact, were orange.
But you couldn't exactly paint them over with. There was no room in the budget for that.
But we knew they were going to be gray in the film, so there was no need to paint them.
Yeah. Well, I know that for the train, that was essentially kind of a poor man's process technique.
That was a real train.
That was a real train? Because it was so dark. It was interesting.
No. We brought that train down. No, yeah.
Okay. I also know that...
You're talking about the train at the camp, not the little toy train.
No. That was completely dark. You know, maybe it was the particular print I was looking at. I wanted to also ask you, because I know that you and Ehud went into this without any kind of distribution deal.
Yeah.
And were there any kind of financial returns or remunerations that were set up before the film was made so you can recoup your investment? Or was this really just a gamble like this?
Just a gamble.
Really?
I mean, these two men, Werner Herzog and Ehud Blyberg, essentially equity financed the film, and they will bear the burden.
Is this really what it takes now? I mean, this is the filmmaking scenario of today, that you now have to essentially just, even someone like you has to make a film without a distribution deal in order to keep making films?
It wasn't that way a year ago. It is the way right now.
Yeah.
I mean, we are looking at a very, very bleak landscape for independent film right now. Bleaker than it's ever been.
Really? In your entire career, you would say this is the bleakest time?
Oh, yes.
What specific factors? I mean, there are plenty we can talk about, but I'm curious.
Two things happened. One is we first shot ourselves in the foot by making too many films with hedge money. Mm-hmm. And we turned off our audiences. Then the economy came by and shot us in the head while we were limping across the room with our broken foot.
Yeah.
And now the money's gone.
Yeah.
So we lost our audiences. Now we lost our money.
Yeah.
I think that the independent film movement almost has to rebirth itself, and I don't know if it'll rebirth itself theatrically.
Yeah.
I mean, the new birth of independent cinema may be in the new media, which means it's quite a few years away.
But it could also be argued that a lot of contemporary independent film is essentially low-budget Hollywood in the narratives that they choose and in the stories that they choose. It's very much something in which it's audience-friendly.
Well, where the damage has been being done is the $5 to $10 million film. Mm-hmm. The digital video, $2 to $3 million film. We're going to see a lot of those. I mean, you're going to see a lot of them, $150,000 films. But you're not going to see what had happened in the last few years, which was a kind of high quality independent film, mm-hmm. of which Adam was one. I don't think there's money for that film anymore.
Yeah. Extreme City, you were going to shoot, as far as I know, you're still going to shoot, but has the Mumbai terrorist scenario.
Well, yeah, that story sort of, Jeff and I were doing an interview for the Hollywood Reporter, and as we were walking out of the hotel, the reporter said to me, "What are you doing?" I said, "Oh, I'm writing this script for this Indian producer to do a Bollywood film." And all of a sudden that became the story, and in our viral world it sort of ran around. But in fact, I'm still writing that script. And if I weren't talking to you right now, I'd be writing right now. So that's still in the writing stages.
Gotcha. But are you still planning on going to Mumbai for this?
It's set in Mumbai.
The terrorist situation hasn't affected anything in terms of insurance or anything like
that? Well, I mean, it's certainly not Mumbai's first brush with terrorism.
Sure.
It's the fourth really serious event they've had there.
Yeah.
It's the highest profile in terms of the West. But 93 was worse, you know, and 2000 was worse, you know.
Gotcha. I also wanted to ask you about the scene in the inherited estate that Jeff Goldblum gets. And that was intriguing to me because it reminded me very much of the opening to Lolita and Claire Quilty coming in. I was wondering if there was any kind of cinematic parallel here.
No. It's just, it is kind of similar in that welcome to Valhalla kind of way.
Yeah.
But just as an example of the complexity of the book, that we shot a scene where after the war, Adam keeps the commandant alive in an attic and has transformed him into a Semitic scholar, translating texts, wearing a kippah, and comes to give him his two fennings he gets every week in a condom.
Mm-hmm.
And we shot that scene, and this is it. And I always love that scene, and it's the scene that is probably most faithful to the tone of the book. Mm-hmm. And when we started showing the movie, it so threw people. Why is that commandant still alive? What's he doing in that attic? Why is he wearing a yarmulke? You know, all of this. So we had to cut it out because it just threw people. We'll put it on the DVD, but that scene, probably most of all, was kind of representative of the sort of nasty and bizarre and magically real nature of the book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, talking about this being a magical, realistic film, is there some kind of verisimilitude on a minimum level that is required? I mean, you do have the bottles of liquor behind the radiator and the like, and I'm wondering if things like this are incorporated to have just some level of reality in amidst this hyper-reality.
Well, people are dressed in a practical way. I mean, it all is sort of, when you see that weird Bauhaus hospital in the middle of the Negev Desert, you know this is kind of a metaphorical hospital.
Yeah.
You know, even if it's not exactly spelled out, and that's part of the license you take to tell such a story, you know, where the head nurse, you know, barks like a dog.
Yeah. Well, speaking of barking like dogs, I mean, I have to ask, did you have any of the actors study dog movement at all?
Jeff hung out with this guy, the dog whisperer guy, and the boy who plays the dog.
Tudor?
Yeah, Tudor. He spent a fair amount of time with dogs, and the dog in the film, Sam, he was with us quite a while. Jeff spent quite a bit of time with Sam, the two of them.
Tudor is hiding under the blanket, at least, you know, that's what we are led to believe. I don't think that he hid under the blanket the entire time, or did he? I mean, was there at any point, like, somebody else? Did he have a dog double? Was there a Tudor double? Was there an actual dog there?
No, that's always Tudor.
Really?
Yeah, he was a rather exceptional kid. He was 12 at the time. Smart as a whip. He had just placed fourth in the Romanian Academic Olympics.
Wow.
He was a really, but he was totally into that whole dog. He would play a dog even when we weren't shooting.
And the actors were perfectly okay and happy. They felt fairly safe, essentially, being dogs like this, because it is you know, putting on all fours. I don't think I've done that for longer than an hour, I suppose, in my life. And so I'm wondering, what did you do to ensure that their performances would be safe to perform and have this, I guess, canine verisimilitude, I suppose.
Well, I mean, you know, you have to sort of watch out for their knees. You can hurt your knees trying to go around on all fours.
I wanted to clear up some of the Peter Biskin stuff with you. I know you've been asked about it a lot, but I'm specifically curious about the much reported scenario in which you often had a loaded gun, or you had a gun that you put to your temple when you couldn't write. I'm curious, was this kind of your own personal nod to Chekhov's loaded gun theory, or
no.
How much truth is there to it? I mean, it's been reported a few other places too.
There is some truth to it, not nearly as much as you know, things get hyperbolized and then they get repeated. And particularly in the Biskin book, which is not just in my case, and virtually everybody he writes about, it's all, it's a mixture of hearsay and gossip, you know. And he had an interesting subject. He could have written an interesting book, but he chose to write the other book. And I knew it perfectly well in my case, because he had a story about Richard Pryor and I. And I said, you know, Peter, that never happened. And he said, I have a source for it. I said, well, what source can it be? Is it Pryor? He said, no, it's not Pryor. I said, well, there's only two of us in the room, Richard and I. And he said, well, the source is your brother. I said, my brother isn't in the room. And I was in the room, and I'm telling you it didn't happen. Yeah. And he said, look, my publisher says I have a source. That's all that matters.
Yeah. Well, did you have any...
So, in fact, he knew it was false, but he had a source, and it was a good story, so he printed it. You have to read that entire book with that in mind.
Yeah, yeah. But did you have anything resembling a gun or any kind of... What did you do when you couldn't write? What do you now do when you can't write?
No, I mean, at the time I wrote Taxi Driver, I was carrying around a gun.
Yeah.
And the very first money I ever made, I went straight into psychotherapy 5 days a week because I knew, you know, I was in trouble. And the Taxi Driver is a crazy script,
yeah.
And it reflects that state of mind that I had at that time. But I knew I was not well, and I set about trying to heal myself. And then, you know, it took quite a few years. I don't even know if I would recognize that kid who wrote Taxi Driver anymore.
But certainly, just about every writer who's talented has a little bit of craziness in them.
Absolutely,
huh? Yeah.
Because, that's what it's all about. You know, you have to exorcise those demons.
Yeah. Have you exorcised all of your demons? I don't know if you have.
Well, I mean, sometimes you sort of wish for some demons, you know, to exorcise, you know. Although I keep getting reminded of Sam Peckinpah, who I knew. And Sam was the kind of guy who could only really work out of humiliation. I mean, he had to have ruined his health, yeah. Ruined his reputation, lost his money, be basically on the barroom floor, face down, with everyone laughing at him, and then he could get himself up and get going again. And he did this three times in his career. And then finally he ran into something that didn't allow him to get up.
Yeah.
He ran into cocaine, and he couldn't get up, and he died.
Well, working the, you know, this tier of the independent film industry is...
So with that in mind, I'm not terribly interested in pressing those buttons that hard.
Yeah. But here you are, you're occupying this, by your own admission, the bleakest period of independent film history. Do you find that maybe there's some sort of advantage in being in this particular spot? Or?
Well, I mean, I've had a nice run. I've had a very interesting career, and in some ways a kind of certainly a remarkable career, in some ways a miraculous career. You know, I look back and I was kind of amazed that I've been able to do as much as I have. And I have had an ability to land on my own two feet, and right now I think those two feet should be in the subcontinent. And that's purely a survival mechanism.
Well, Paul, thanks very much for your time. It's a pleasure chatting with you.
All right.
Thanks.
She's sorry, she's been stranded at these parties. And these parties, they start lovely, but they get druggy and they get ugly and they get bloody. The priest just kind of laughed. The deacon caught a draft. She crashed into the Easter Mass with her hair done up in broken glass. She was limping left on broken heels, and she said, "Father, can I tell your congregation?"